Thank you for coming in week 9 when most people have already left Oxford, so I'm thankful that you are here today. So just to give you a brief outline of my presentation today, I'm going to be talking about a project that we have just completed. The project is entitled The Impact of Transitional Justice on Human Rights and Democracy. And we're very lucky to have the two PIs here today, so you get three people in one single event. So I will be focusing especially on the issue of amnesties and challenges to amnesties in Latin America. And then towards the end, for the last 15 minutes, I will be talking about the case study of Uruguay. Just to give you a brief overview of the project, this project began in 2010 and was funded jointly by the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council and the US National Science Foundation. And this project has its main goal the attempt to explore three mechanisms of transitional justice: amnesties, trials, and truth commission. And in particular, to look at the interaction between these three mechanisms and see when, why, and how this mechanism advanced human rights and democracy in transitional countries. This project is the result of a collaboration between Professor Payne from the University of Oxford and Professor Sinking from the University of Minnesota. And the project had two teams working together. So one team under Professor Sinking in Minneapolis and the other team with Professor Payne here. And I would like to mention three of my colleagues in particular that helped us in the work on amnesties and challenges: Gabriel Pereira, Emily Bray, that was the former OTGR events manager, so some of you may know her, and Pierre Legoff. The project focused on 76 transitional countries between 1970 and 2011. And we are hoping to update the information for 2012 in the near future. The main goal of the project was to create a database which contains information about these three mechanisms of transitional justice, as I said, trials, amnesties, and truth commissions. And the reasons why I am focusing on Latin America for today's talk is the fact that at least in the section of our work that related to amnesty laws, we noticed that Latin America was an outlier for two reasons. The first, it was an outlier in terms of the high number of amnesties for human rights violations committed by state agents. But then it was also an outlier in terms of the attempts to challenge the amnesties and try to find ways to overcome these laws in order to achieve some form of justice. So if some of you have read the book by Claire Moon on the Truth Commission in South Africa, you may remember that she argues that in transitional justice, there is a tendency to adopt a dichotomous framing in terms of the central issues in this field. So she says that some of the key debates are summarized by phrases such as truth versus justice or peace versus justice, and also the debate between trials or amnesties. And in the project, we have tried to go beyond this opposition between different goals or mechanisms of transitional justice to actually focus on the reality in these 76 transitional countries, where we have seen that in practice, trials and amnesties do coexist. So they are not exclusionary mechanisms or positions. And some of the starting point for the research on amnesties was a quantitative study that was done previously to this project by Olsen, Payne, and Reiter in the Justice Imbalance publication, where through a statistical analysis, there was evidence that amnesties did have a positive impact on human rights and democracies when they were used together with trials or with trials and truth commissions. So the goal for this part of the project was to take this statistical finding and try to look at it through a qualitative analysis of the types of amnesties and the nature of amnesties. So what we tried to understand by looking at the cases in our database was to see why we had a persistence of amnesty laws, even though we also found that the possibility of justice had been increasing across the world. And so we wanted to look a bit more closely at the nature of amnesty laws and look in particular at what sort of crimes and what sort of perpetrators they were benefiting, and also time periods relating to these amnesty laws. And thirdly, we also were particularly interested in seeing whether justice was at all possible in a context of amnesty laws. And I want to show you this graph that was created by one of our colleagues in Minnesota, Jeff Dancy. And this graph actually shows some of the points that I was just making. The gray line is relates to trial verdicts for prosecutions for human rights violations, and the orange line is the one for amnesties for past human rights violations. And as you can see, there has been a spike in the numbers of prosecutions for past human rights violations, so justice seems possible in recent years, and much more so than in the early 1970s. But what we also see is that even though the number of amnesty laws has decreased, they have not completely disappeared, and they continue to be used as one of the mechanisms for dealing with past human rights violations. And in one of the chapters of the book that you've seen the flyer around, Louise Malinder also makes a similar argument. She has created her own database on amnesty laws, and she similarly makes the point that amnesties have been have continued to be enacted at a steady rate over the past 30 years. So amnesties seem to be here to stay, and that's why we were interested to unpacking a bit more what these amnesty laws were and what sort of provisions they had. Just to give you some information on the data in our database and some of the definitions. We used as sources for our database two pre-existing databases. The first, which I just mentioned, is the Amnesty Law database that was created and compiled by Louise Malinder, who's based at the Transitional Justice Institute in Ulster in Ireland. And the second was the Transitional Justice Database by Olsen, Payne, and Reiter that had been compiled before Professor Payne came here to Oxford. So what we did in using this data is we merged these two databases, and we came up with a universe of over 400 amnesty laws. But then we focused specifically on 56 amnesties that met three specific conditions that we had identified as part of our research. So the first condition was that these amnesties had to be for human rights violations. You can have many different types of amnesties. You can have amnesties for military coups, or you can have amnesties that release political prisoners. So there are many different types of amnesties throughout the world. So the first sort of eligibility criteria for us was that the law had to be for human rights violations, and especially violations of so-called physical integrity rights, so extrajudicial execution, torture, disappearances, etc. Of course, very few law use these terms specifically. They have wording such as political and common crimes, because many states are trying not to say very clearly what they're doing with these amnesties, but because we took a long time to study these laws and with the context we could identify what crimes these amnesties were really targeting. Secondly, the other criteria was that we were interested in particular in human rights violations that had been perpetrated by state agents or agents that are acting on behalf of the state. So, for example, paramilitary groups that may not be formally recognized by the state, but they are carrying out human rights violations in on behalf of the state. And finally, the third criteria was the focus on the so-called authoritarian range. We were looking at human rights violations that had happened within a specific time period. So for each country, we identified a specific time period which related to when the country was living through an authoritarian government. And so the human rights violations had to be perpetrated within this specific time frame in order to be included in our database. So all of these 400 plus amnesties are in the database, but then we coded in much more detail these 56 amnesties, because for these 56 amnesties we were interested in really identifying the types of perpetrators that were benefited by the law, the types of crimes, and the time frames. In terms of our definition of amnesty, if you are familiar with the literature, you will see that there are many different definitions. So we operationalized and we came up with this definition for the coders to use when they were coding the amnesties. And we have a broad definition that encompasses both amnesties per se, but also pardons. So amnesties are usually granted before a criminal investigation and a trial takes place, while pardons are the same, but for those people that have already been prosecuted and sentenced by a criminal court. And we decided to adopt this broad classification because we realized that amnesties have taken many different forms across the world, and also we realized that we didn't want to have a restrictive amnesties that a restrictive definition that may leave out some amnesties that actually did meet our three criteria. And we also kept in our database self-amnesties, which are amnesties that the authoritarian government passed to protect itself and its members from prosecution in the future. But we kept only self-amnesties that were later accepted and officially recognized by democratic governments. For example, in both Brazil and Chile, the Supreme Court and the government in democracy have maintained and accepted the amnesty law. So those two examples would be contained in the database. Moving on, just to give you a bit of an overview of the situation of amnesties and pardons in Latin America. If you look at the orange table, you will see that out of the total of 56 amnesties, exactly half of them are in Latin America. So 50% of all of the amnesties that were, for us, a fit of our criteria are in Latin America. And also another important point, if you look at the gray table, is that the vast majority of these 28 amnesties, so 24 amnesties, were adopted between 1985 and 1998. And if some of you are familiar with the history of that continent, this will not be a surprise for you, because these two decades was when the vast majority of the countries had the transition back to democracy. And so amnesty laws, the vast majority of the amnesties for Latin America were adopted in this time frame. And finally, in this table over here, you will see the 10 countries in Latin America that have amnesty laws that were matched our three criteria. And in some cases, like Argentina, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua, you have more than one amnesty. being enacted by the government for similar types of crimes. Before I go any further, I just wanted to say a couple of words about barriers to obtaining justice in Latin America, because of course I think when we think of obstacles to justice, amnesty is probably the first image that comes to our mind. And of course it is true that self-amnesties by authoritarian regimes or amnesties passed by democratic governments are obstacles to justice, but they are not the only ones. So I think before I go any further with the talk, I just would like you to keep in mind some other obstacles that exist in the context of attempting to get justice for past human rights violations. And the first one is the lack of political will to investigate past human rights abuses. And we have seen in many other countries across the world where we don't have amnesties, we still see that no advances or no progress happens in terms of justice. So the role of governments, and in Latin America, the role of specific presidents, does play an important role in understanding whether or not justice can happen. And also another factor that was particularly important is the presence and the power of spoilers. And in particular in Latin America and as well as other countries is the role of the armed and security forces that of course have an interest in keeping impunity and not disclosing information about the sort of atrocities that they perpetrated. But also, I think former political elites play a role, because although there is the image of the military authoritarian government, at least in the case of Latin America, there was a high degree of complicity from politicians, businesses, and other parts of society. So the military regimes were not self-sustaining, but there were many different levels of complicity as well. And finally, in some of the countries that we looked at, we also saw a high level of judicial resistance to using international law, and especially international human rights law, which in some cases has resulted in slower progress in terms of justice. I want to move on now to what I think is one of the most innovative aspects of this research project, which is the focus on challenges to amnesty laws. And the reason why we focused on challenges to amnesty was that we were particularly interested in seeing whether amnesty laws continued untouched throughout time, or whether they were subject to criticism or questioning, and also whether it was possible in some cases to see the amnesty law being weakened and even completely removed from the legal system in order to allow for prosecutions to take place. As you can see from this slide, we looked at challenges that were happening on two levels, domestic level and international level. We conceptualized challenges as quite narrowly, because we focused on legal processes and not on any social and political mobilizations against amnesties. In many countries in Latin America, I'm thinking of Argentina, for example, right after the amnesty laws were enacted, you had massive street mobilizations against the amnesty. But that's not the sort of challenge that we had in mind. We were focusing on legal processes that attempted to modify the scope, validity, and application of the amnesty law. And so the first type of challenges were domestic attempts that tried to modify the legal scope of the amnesty law, whether in the attempt to exclude certain types of crimes from the amnesty or certain types of perpetrators from the amnesty or the time period. And I think the most famous example, if some of you are familiar with the case of Chile, is exactly the concept of disappearance as a permanent crime. In Chile, for example, there was an amnesty law passed by Pinochet regime in 1978, which was maintained by the democratic government. But in the late 1990s, human rights lawyers were able to limit the application of the amnesty by using the argument that disappearance was a permanent crime and continued crime that was still being perpetrated even 20 years later. And because of this innovative legal argument, nowadays you have trials being allowed in Chile for disappearances, even though the amnesty law in Chile remains overall valid. So this is an example of the domestic challenges that we tried to code in our database. But then we were also interested in trying to code attempts that were trying to completely eliminate the amnesty law, whether it was a derogation, so an elimination into the future, or a nullification, which means that the amnesty law has never existed. We then also looked at challenges outside of each of the countries, so at the international level. And we particularly focused on challenges in the case of Latin America at the Inter-American Human Rights System by looking at the Inter-American Commission and the Inter-American Court. But we also coded challenges by international non-governmental organization, and we focused on three of them. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and International Center for Transitional Justice, because we identified that these three INGOs had led a sustained campaign against impunity over the years. And the purpose of coding both international and domestic challenges was to get a complete picture of all forms of pressures, whether domestic and international, that amnesty laws were being subjected to. And in particular, international challenges had a role in trying to shift the thinking of domestic actors in terms of the validity of amnesty laws. And I just want to give you a quick overview of challenges to amnesty laws by region. And you can see that we recorded a total of over 200 challenges to amnesties throughout the world. And the vast majority, so almost 86% of all the challenges that we found, come from Latin America. And also, I think an important information to keep in mind is that within Latin America, the vast majority of these challenges take place post 1998. And so they are a relatively recent event. And I guess everyone may have a different explanation, but I think 1998 is not a casual number, but it was the year when Pinochet was charged and arrested here in London, which for many scholars is a sort of watershed moment in terms of transitional justice. Of course, there were many challenges before, so it was a movement that was building since the 1990s. But I think it's quite interesting to see that there has been a spike from 1998 onwards in terms of challenges to amnesties. And I realize this is quite small. I hope you can still see it. This is a breakdown of all of the challenges that we recorded for the 10 Latin American countries. And as you can see, many of the challenges are taking place domestically, but probably an equal number is taking place at the international level. And I highlighted those four boxes because we see only in two countries that we have challenges to amnesties happening through the government and through the electoral process.
Sorry.
Yeah.
The executive says seven.
Yeah, because yes, it's seven, but it's only in two countries where we see that we don't see just challenges in the judicial system, but the executive and the legislature also are involved in the process of challenges and amnesties. So, as I was saying with the previous table, we found that the majority of challenges takes place through the judicial system, in particular through the courts, domestic courts, but also through the Inter-American system and the UN treaty bodies system. And as I was saying, only in Argentina and Uruguay we see different forms of challenges through the legislature, executive, and the electoral processes. And also we've noticed that a high number of challenges takes place at the international level. And in the context of Latin America, we see a particularly progressive role being played by the Inter-American Commission and the Inter-American system in challenging amnesties. And there has been, since the 2001 sentence in the Barrios Altos case, the Inter-American Court has made it quite clear to the member states of the American Convention that the court considers amnesties for human rights violations to be lacking any legal effect because they put countries in a position to be breaching their human rights obligations. And this position of the court, which was first expressed in 2001, has been reiterated in many cases for Peru, Chile, Brazil, Uruguay, and most recently for El Salvador. There was a recent sentence by the court in December 2012 that considered the 1993 amnesty in El Salvador to be breaching international, regional human rights obligations. And this is the last slide on the section on amnesties before we move on to the case studies. And I just wanted to give you a sort of a snapshot of the countries in Latin America. And we can see that Argentina is at the top of the league of countries that see the highest number of challenges to amnesty laws. But then we see a significant number also in El Salvador, Guatemala, Peru, Uruguay, and Chile. And then we have the sort of the bottom group, which is Honduras, Brazil, and Mexico, and Nicaragua, that actually have no challenges at all to their amnesty laws. And from our universe of 56 amnesty laws, we saw that only three countries have effectively removed the amnesties from the legal system. And two of them, Argentina and Uruguay, are in Latin America. And the other case that we found is Bangladesh. So as you can see, out of 56 amnesties, only three have gone. But if you remember the graph that I showed at the beginning, we still have a rising number of trials. So something else is also happening. And I want to move on now to the case study of Uruguay. And as I was preparing for this talk, I was thinking that my last talk here at OTJR was right after Uruguay had derogated the amnesty law. And we had an event here with Chris Hall from Amnesty International. And I think everybody was feeling quite optimistic because the amnesty law had been derogated after 25 years. And so I feel like I'm sort of coming back here, but with a different ending this time, which maybe we didn't expect a year and a half ago when we were presenting the other talk. Just to give you a very brief historical background, because I realize that not many people are familiar with the case of Uruguay. The dictatorships in Latin America are usually identified with Pinochet or the Argentine desaparecidos. They are quite well-known cases. But actually, at the same time that Argentina and Chile were living under a dictatorship, many other countries of the region were suffering a similar fate. including Brazil, Bolivia, Peru, Paraguay, and also Uruguay. So it was a regional context of military regimes that were inspired by the national security doctrine and the context of the Cold War against communism. In terms of human rights repression, Uruguay is famous, I don't know if famous is the right word, but to say that, but was recognized for being the torture chamber of Latin America in the 1970s, because the key repressive strategy was the use of torture and also the use of political imprisonment. By the late 1970s, it was recognized that Uruguay had the highest per capita number of political prisoners in the whole world. And Uruguay is a tiny country, it had less than 3 million people at the time, so to have such a high number of political prisoners is quite an achievement. Uruguay returned to democracy through a negotiated transition between politicians and the armed forces, and the democratic government took over in March 1st, 1985. And unlike Argentina or Chile, where we see right after the transition the establishment of a national truth commission in Chile, or in Argentina we see the prosecution of the military commanders and a truth commission being established to shed light on the human rights violations, in Uruguay we don't see anything of that sort happening. The government has no interest in clarifying the fate of the disappeared or to investigate any of the violations that were perpetrated. Nonetheless, the judiciary starts to investigate some cases because victims could still go to the courts and allege that they had suffered human rights violations. And because courts began to investigate exactly cases of murder, torture, and disappearances, we see the enactment of the amnesty law. Of course, the armed forces had no interest in going to court, and they actually made it clear saying that none of the summoned officers would show up to the courts to provide information or be prosecuted. And because of this threat of military insubordination and institutional crisis, the government of President Sanguinetti, I love that photo up there, adopts, together with some parts of the opposition, the so-called ley de caducidad. And just going through quickly some of the key provisions. The amnesty was for military and police officers that had perpetrated crimes for political motives or in fulfillment of their functions or following orders. And this is quite a standard language for amnesty laws that we found in many other cases, so this is not at all particular to Uruguay. But what I think is particular to Uruguay is this last part, because the amnesty law set up what I say was a perverse system, because it violated the separation of powers. And if a judge received an allegation of a human rights crime, the judge had to stop and transmit all the information to the executive. And it was the executive who would decide whether the allegation should fall under the amnesty law or not. So a task which belongs to the judicial power was basically taken away and put in the hands of the executive. And so for 20 years, the executive consistently applied the amnesty law to all the cases. So any denunciation of human rights violations that ever reached the court was sent to the executive, and all of the cases were automatically archived and shelved through the amnesty. And the same with cases of disappearances. There was an article in the law saying that the executive had to investigate disappearances, which they did, and then one can make a decision on whether these investigations were actually if they met standards of investigations into human rights violations. And I think the general agreement is that they were sham investigations. Just the first actually went as far as saying that there hadn't been any disappearances in Uruguay. And talking about some of the challenges to the Ley de Caducidad, unfortunately there are too many challenges and too little time for me to talk you through all of them. But I think the main point in the case of Uruguay is to know that the day after the law was passed, you had the first challenge already being launched. So it was a process that took 25 years to eliminate the law, but started very early on. Civil society was very much mobilized in trying to overturn this law. And there were many different types of challenges in Uruguay, from the attempts to hold a referendum on the law, to appeals to Supreme Court of Justice to have the law declared unconstitutional, petitions to the Inter-American system and to the UN Human Rights Committee. Of course, all of the international negative criticism by all of these bodies were never taken into account by the democratic governments. The first break to the logic and the application of impunity in Uruguay took place in 2002, so this is 17 years after the democratic transition. You have the first trial being allowed to proceed in Uruguay. And it was thanks to a challenge to the amnesty and the argument that was developed by civil society, and in particular by a former labor lawyer now turned into human rights lawyer, that argued to the judge that Article 1 of the amnesty law only talks about military and police officials. So if a civilian is implicated in a disappearance, surely the amnesty law shouldn't apply to the case of a civilian. And for the first time, Judge Cavalli actually accepted this argument, and the trial of the former foreign minister Blanco was allowed to continue, first as an investigation and then finally as a trial. And in 2005, which is the second important turning point in Uruguay, we see, if you see in the photo over there, the first left-wing president being elected in the history of Uruguay. And in parallel to the presidency of the first left-wing government, we see that building on the precedent of the exceptions to the amnesty, many more cases are allowed to go through. So even though the amnesty remains overall valid, through exceptions such as crimes committed by civilians or crimes committed by the high-ranking military officials, because the law talked about following orders. So if you were giving the orders, you are not covered by the amnesty. So by this system of really unpacking the law and using all the possible exceptions, we have between 2005 and 2011 almost 30 prosecutions starting to take place for human rights violations. But even though we have the first opening in terms of accountability, the Frente Amplio, so the left-wing government, was still reluctant. The amnesty was overall in place. They were allowing some cases to go forward, but the law was still standing. And civil society pushed the government through many different ways. There was a second vote on the amnesty law being held, and it was lost. The Inter-American Court received a case, again from Uruguay, the Inter-American Commission received a case which then reached the Inter-American Court for the first time ever in Uruguay. There were other appeals by victims to the Supreme Court, which for the first time in 2009 declared the amnesty law to be unconstitutional. So by October 2011, which is what was when I was giving my last talk here, we got to the point where the Frente Amplio government finally derogated the amnesty law. And what caught at least my eye when this happened was that nobody was celebrating in Uruguay. And I couldn't understand why. You've been fighting for this for 25 years, and why are you not celebrating? And I think this is why they were not celebrating. And I had to also add another slide to my presentation between now and when I was sick, because some other events have proved the fact that maybe there was no reason yet to celebrate for Uruguay. And I might skip this because I have 5 minutes left and talk about what has happened over the past 2 weeks, which has shown how, even though the amnesty law is no longer standing, there remain very significant obstacles to prosecutions in Uruguay. The first is 2 weeks ago, on February 13th, the Supreme Court of Justice transferred a criminal court judge, Mariana Mota, that you see in the photo, to a civil court. She was the judge that was dealing with the vast majority of cases of past human rights violations in Uruguay, and she had not requested the transfer, and she had not been accused of misconduct. The transfer came out of the blue. She was also quite renowned because in 2010 she condemned the former dictator Bordaberry to prison because of his role as the leader of the military coup in the 1970s. So it was quite a historic sentence. And also, she was the only judge in Uruguay that applied international human rights law. She actually prosecuted people for the crime of disappearance, while 99% of the other judges in Uruguay use murder, because there is no disappearance in the domestic legislation until 2006 in Uruguay, so they use murder. This judge had suffered attacks and pressure from both the Supreme Court and the politicians, so not many people were surprised to see her being transferred, but unfortunately, the vast majority of cases that she was dealing with have been now put on hold. So this is yet another delay in terms of prosecution. And then less than 2 weeks later, the Supreme Court of Justice again released a sentence in which it considered parts of the law that derogated the amnesty law to be unconstitutional. And although they have said that the Ley de Caducidad is derogated and remains so, what they have argued is that the crimes of the dictatorship are not crimes against humanity, they are only common crimes, and therefore many of them have already prescribed. And for this, both acts, but especially this last verdict, was criticized throughout the world. Even the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, which is usually quite slow in reacting, emitted the next day a very strong statement expressing concern about Uruguay. There were criticisms by Amnesty International, CEHIL, the Center for Justice and International Law, and many other human rights NGOs, because through this sentence, the Supreme Court is effectively halting all criminal investigations because the crimes have expired in the eyes of the Supreme Court. So just in the last few minutes, some some conclusion. So first of all, as I was saying in the beginning, Latin America has been quite of an outlier region, not just because they had the largest number of amnesties for human rights violations, but also because it has the greatest success in terms of challenging impunity and trying to find ways around amnesty laws and factual impunity. And I think the case study of Uruguay really brings to light this tension between factual and legal impunity, because you had the Ley de Caducidad for 25 years and you had no investigations and very limited justice. And then you are without the ley de caducidad now, and there are still other forms of impunity that generate other obstacles and barriers in terms of achieving justice for human rights violations. In terms of our project, we identified three key factors that had an impact on the prospect for accountability and the prospect for justice. And I mentioned some of them already in the talk: the role of political leadership, and especially of some specific presidents. If we think of President Néstor Kirchner in Argentina, it's quite clear that the recent wave of prosecutions in the country coincides with the presidency of Néstor Kirchner and his wife. The role of international pressure, I didn't have time to talk about it, but the Inter-American Court sentence in the Hellman case of Uruguay that declared the Ley de Caducidad to be lacking legal effect was used very strategically in Uruguay to finally get the government to derogate the amnesty law. And of course, civil society demands for accountability and justice. So I guess the takeaway point for you after this presentation is that justice is still possible, even if there is an amnesty law. And I think the story of Latin America is that there are ways to try to go around amnesty laws and impunity. And some of these are, for example, the idea of disappearance as a permanent crime that continues to take place, and it allows, in some cases, for prosecutions. The concept of crimes against humanity as not being subject to statutes of limitation, so it does not matter when these crimes were perpetrated, because there is a duty to prosecute and punish these types of atrocities. And then in the specific context of Latin America, we've seen prosecutions happen through the so-called Operation Condor, because these crimes of Operation Condor happened throughout the region, so they fell outside domestic laws, so victims could go to another country and file claims for prosecutions. And also the case of baby kidnapping and changing of identity have been declared as crimes against humanity, so they can be prosecuted. And finally, this is a section of the book launch. Hopefully this is happening during term, so you can join us for the launch of my updated and very much revised PhD thesis, and Professor Payne will be chairing the event, and Professor Sikking will be the discussant. So if you can join us, it would be great to have you there. And thank you very much for your attention.